From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
I started work in the city in 1961, and I saw eternity written on the footpaths for years. And I always wondered what it was about or why it was written there. I never knew, like so many other people. And initially it was written in white chalk, and then it was written in yellow crayon. And I've since learnt that the white chalk washed off in the rain, whereas the yellow crayon stayed.
This is David Lever. I spoke with him recently at a book launch. The book is called Mr. Eternity, and it tells the story of a man named Arthur Stace. David had no idea who Arthur was at the time that he saw eternity written on many footpaths that he walked on, but he later came to know him quite well, or know about him at least. He created a series of paintings about Arthur Stace's life, including his very troubled childhood. There's one image of Arthur and his siblings hiding under their house in Balmain from their parents, who were violent alcoholics. David was impressed that Arthur survived everything he survived and emerged from it all with this determined message.
We've all got doubts about our lives, and he just had one focus. And I admired that, and I thought that was inspiring.
Every day for more than 30 years, between the 1930s and 1960s, Arthur Stace would head out, walking the streets of Sydney for hours and writing the word eternity in this beautiful script on the city's footpaths. Like David says, most people had no idea who was writing it or why it was written, because Mr. Eternity's identity was a secret for almost 20 years.
As a child, about 6, 7, 8 year old, for a few years, I did see Arthur Stace walking around the streets in Balmain, where I grew up. Many corners, even in the corner of the street where I lived on a footpath, right in the corner of the footpath, I would see Arthur Stace bending down, writing that beautiful word, eternity. And I couldn't even say the word, and I didn't understand the meaning of the word, but I just loved looking at it.
This is Joan Riley. She knows Arthur's name now, but at the time, she and her sister and the other children she played with on the street were intrigued by, in her words, this dear, sweet, humble little man.
And because I played in the streets a lot, and I did see him quite occasionally, yes, walking around in a steady way, always dressed in a navy blue suit, always very neat. But I have no memory of seeing his face smiling. So I try not to be sad about that, but he did certainly make an impression on many people.
Arthur's identity was revealed in 1956, and he became a household name, somewhat reluctantly. He continued writing Eternity until his death in 1967, leaving a permanent mark on the soul of Sydney.
For the first time, the full story of Arthur Stace's life is told in a new biography, Mr. Eternity, by Roy Williams and Elizabeth Myers.
So Elizabeth and Roy, thanks so much for being here.
Our pleasure.
Now, Elizabeth, let's start with you. Arthur Stace was a friend of your father's. You first met him when you were 10 years old. What was your first impression of him?
At first I was a little bit wary of him. He was different. He was small, he had a very weathered face, and he had a gruff voice, and he always had his hat on, and he was just very different to anyone I'd encountered before.
Yeah, and how long did it take for that sort of wariness to melt away?
Oh, not long, because I realised straight away that my father and mother respected him. He was part of the church community. And he was very much loved.
Did you at the time know that he was the one writing Eternity on the footpaths of Sydney?
No, no one at the church knew, not even my father. That took a little bit of time for my father to notice Arthur writing it on the street. But then Arthur had said to him, "Don't tell anyone, will you?" So my father never even shared it with us as a family.
And your dad, I think it had something to do with him, like convincing him to actually share the meaning of this word, right?
Yes, well, he did talk to Arthur about it, but Arthur was very reticent because he was very humble and very shy, and he just felt this was his mission to do for God, and he didn't feel that he needed to share it with anyone. So there was only a few people who knew, just a few ladies in the church who'd seen him doing it, and he'd said the same thing, "Don't tell anyone, will you?" So everyone kept his secret.
So it's a wonderful part of the story, really, because it brings in a certain amount of mystery to it, doesn't it?
It does. Lovely. Yes.
And there was a lot of speculation, wasn't there, about who was doing it?
Well, there'd been articles in the paper. My father had seen them. Column 8 in the Herald had little snippets from time to time. Everyone tried to guess who he was. Arthur thought that was a great joke that no one knew, and that they'd guess who he was. One time he said to a friend, "Oh, we're school teachers now, Edith." He thought that was great fun.
Roy, you came on board with this project and you started looking into Arthur's early life. What did you find out about that?
Well, I got a great head start from Elizabeth, I must say. But yes, I did do some extra research of my own. He was born in 1885 in the slums of inner Sydney. His father was a drunk. He was a no-hoper. Although he'd come from an upper-class English background, he couldn't hold down a job, and the six children really, really struggled. Arthur and his brother and older sister used to scavenge for food on the doorsteps of other people's houses. They used to pinch bread and lollies from shop counters and anything they could get their hands on. So it was a really tough upbringing in his early childhood.
So we'd characterise it now as really quite a, traumatic childhood.
Yes, it was deprived. His mother ultimately became a prostitute in the Haymarket district. But by that stage, Arthur had actually been given up by his mother to foster care. At the age of 7, which must have, what we know, was the most traumatic experience of his whole life, is the one aspect of it he really never wanted to talk about with anybody, even with Elizabeth's father. But being given up to foster care, he was sent to Goulburn on his own with an elderly widow and spent 7 years there before he was fostered out again down the south coast, down near Wollongong, and spent a few years working in a coal mine. That was the sort of early life he had.
And alcohol was a part of this?
Yes. With his first pay, he shouted his mates a jug of beer. And he always said that was the start of just a catastrophic addiction for him.
That was what age?
14.
Wow.
He spent the next 30 years of his life really unable to hold down a job. He drifted, when he eventually came back to Sydney, he drifted into petty crime. Then he went off to World War I, where he acted as a stretcher bearer on the Western Front in early 1917. Came back, as many Australian men did, shell-shocked, traumatised, unable to readjust to civilian life. And the 1920s were really just a write-off. The police picked him up on countless occasions, tossed him into the jail cell overnight, and kicked him out in the morning. You know, that was his life.
He had a huge turning point. Tell us about that. What happened, and how was his life different after that?
Yes, on the 6th of August 1930. We know the precise date because Arthur never forgot it. He took himself along to St Barnabas Church of England on Broadway, which was a famous church. So this was the height of the Great Depression. 30% unemployment and countless men just like Arthur. He and a few mates had heard that if you went up to St Barnabas on a Wednesday night, you could get a cup of tea and a rock cake.
It's an attractive offer.
That's right. But the condition was you had to sit through a gospel sermon.
Less attractive, maybe.
Indeed. And Arthur used to joke about this. He was there with a couple of his old criminal mates, and they were sitting in the audience, and Arthur could see these six men who were different to everyone else, seated at the front, all dressed respectably and, you know, clean and very good looking. And Arthur said to his mate, "Who are they?" And his mate said, "Oh, they're Christians." Others said, well, look at them and look at us. I'm having something of what they've got. Arthur swore that after the sermon was ended and he had his cup of tea and rock cake, he walked across into Victoria Park, just across the street, knelt down under a fig tree and wept and prayed. Prayed the prayer of the repentant publican, which was very apt for Arthur. God be merciful to me, a sinner. Hammond had convinced him that his sense of hopelessness and despair was his sin talking, and that he had to repent of that. And I mean, this sounds like a very sanctimonious sort of message, but the fact of the matter is that is what Arthur believed, and he repented that night, and he was a changed man. He never touched a drop of alcohol for the rest of his life.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
I'm old enough to remember the Chalkings. I remember seeing them in the Haymarket area of Sydney when I was probably 4 or 5. Also, I knew Martin Sharp, the artist, and I was aware of his fascination with eternity.
This is Remo Geoffrey. Back in the 80s and early 90s, he had a general store on the corner of Crown and Oxford Street, a major intersection in Sydney's CBD. He ran an eternity promotion, a dedication really to Arthur Stace, using the very word written the way Arthur wrote it and developing a range of merchandise around it. Remo tells me that eternity resonated with him because his store was all about buy it once and own it forever, not stuff that you throw out after a few years.
I had long wanted Martin Sharp to do something for our banner Crown Street window, which was this 5-metre window facing Oxford and Crown Street, very high profile, and we'd been featuring a lot of interesting cultural things there. I was over at his place in Bellevue Hill. One day I had a template of the 5-metre window, and then all of a sudden he just grabbed a marker pen and wrote the word eternity across that template of the window, and we looked at each other and realised, of course, that was the idea, that he should do that in the window. That would be the dedication to Arthur Stace, and then we would merchandise from there. So,
it's been said that this campaign, Eternity in a 5-metre window facing Sydney's bustling intersection of Oxford and Crown Streets in Darlinghurst, it's this revival of Arthur Stace's legacy that led to it showing up on Sydney's Harbour Bridge at the turn of the millennium.
So is it true then that really you're the guy behind it being on the bridge for New Year's in 2000?
It's very flattering. It probably is. I'll tell you why. One of our customers was a gentleman by the name of Rick Birch, who was the organiser and creative director of that event. So I have to think that his passion for that imagery was brought to light as a result of him being the recipient of my catalogues year after year and our merchandise. So you can thank Rick as much as you can thank me. So
Roy, let's go back to the beginning. How did Arthur Stace come upon this word eternity, and why did he start writing it on the streets?
In November of 1932, he took himself down to the Burton Street Baptist Tabernacle in Darlinghurst, where a visiting evangelist, a man called John Ridley, was preaching a series of sermons. Arthur turned up on a Monday night where the subject was Echoes of Eternity. And Ridley was a great Australian preacher, one of the real old school fire and brimstone sort of characters. And at the end of this sermon, Ridley shouted out to the congregation, "I wish that I could sound or shout that word eternity to the whole of Sydney." And Arthur was so inspired, he said he left the tabernacle, and on the pavement outside, finding an old piece of chalk in his pocket, who knows why it was there, he bent down and wrote the word out on the pavement. And it came out in this beautiful copper plate script. And he was so impressed by it. He was astonished at how well it came out, because he wasn't a well-educated man. He wasn't illiterate, but he'd always had trouble with writing. And yet this one word came out so beautifully. And Arthur always swore, and there's no reason to doubt him, that he wrote that word on the pavements of Sydney and beyond every day, 50 times a day or thereabouts, for the rest of his life. So another 35 years, 500,000 times in all.
It's kind of a strange mission, right, to set yourself. What's your sense of what he believed himself to be doing?
He was interviewed about this late in life. Why did you do it? And he said, well, I believe we're in this world for one of two things, to be a help or a hindrance. And for him, he wanted to be a help. It was his gift to the people of Sydney. He wanted them to know that there's an eternity to face. So it was a serious message. But at the same time, Arthur said, it's a lovely thing to know if you're living for it. He'd done that for 35 years, and his life since living for eternity had just been infinitely better than the horrific life he'd lived for 45 years before that.
Am I right in saying that what he was doing was illegal? You weren't actually allowed to chalk?
Well, he was pulled up by the policeman 21 times. And they said to him, you're not allowed to do this. But he said, I knew that it wasn't the police in charge of the city walk, pavements. He said, I knew that they belonged to the council. So he said, I just didn't take any notice of them. He said, and after a while, they said, well, look how he used to be, lying in the gutters everywhere drunk. Isn't it better to see him doing this? So he thought it was quite funny, really, that he'd been pulled up by the police. But it didn't deter him.
You're right, though. Strictly speaking, what he was doing was illegal. And indeed still is in every other state of Australia except New South Wales. It wasn't until 2014 that the New South Wales Parliament actually passed a law, which is known as Arthur's Law, making it legal to write in chalk on a public footpath.
Roy, the way you described that, how he's not a particularly educated person and probably didn't write a lot, but out it came in this beautiful handwriting. Did he think of that as some sort of supernatural thing?
Close. He certainly saw it as a gift that God had granted him in some mysterious way, that this one word looked so much better than any other word he could write. And it's true, in fact, if you look at the few surviving letters that he wrote, His prose is a dog's breakfast, but this single word is a work of art.
Elizabeth, are there any surviving original inscriptions of eternity that we know of?
Yes, we know of three. One is inside the bell of the GPO. We believe that Arthur went there one day and the bell had been taken down to be stored away during the war. And he saw it on the ground, and so he wrote eternity inside the bell. And, of course, they were staggered, the workmen, when they came the next day and found it inside the bell. He didn't really like to sort of do it for people, but there was a lady at the church that pestered him a little bit about writing it for her. And so she came in one day, and after church, we all used to have lunch together, she presented him with a piece of black cardboard, and she said, Arthur, would you write eternity on this for me to keep? And he had terrible trouble with it, according to one of the guys at the church, because he was used to bending down and writing it on the ground. And he was trying to do it on a table. So in the end, he had to put it down on the ground and write it so it fitted on the piece of black cardboard. She kept it for many years. And then there was a minister, a visiting minister, came to the church. She gave it to him and he kept it for a long time. And then he gave it to the National Gallery in Canberra. The third one that is around is one that he did for my mother. When he was in the nursing home towards the end of his life, I don't know whether she asked him, but he wrote eternity in biro on a piece of A4 paper. Now, you can certainly, you know, see that it's him, but it hasn't got the same effect as being in chalk.
Not the fluency,
yes. Yes, but he signed it. And so we know it was his because his name, his signature is there. And I've also got his signature in his New Testament, which he gave to Mum as a gift. So we know that that was his signature. So that is the third one that we know is still around.
It's interesting to me to wonder whether or not the time he was doing this was a time in which people at least had a kind of shared language and conceptual framework by which even that one word had the sort of resonance that it did. And I wonder if it would be different today.
Yes, I think that's right, Simon. So Arthur was doing it from the 30s to the mid-60s. And this was still a time when 90% or thereabouts of the Australian population identified with Christianity. And we're now down at 50% and plummeting. So yes, I guess in that sense there was a shared knowledge.
And the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, the Old Testament part of the Bible, talks about that God has put eternity in the hearts of every person. So in a sense, you would expect, if that's true, that this word still connects with people. Is that what you've discovered in the way you've
yes.
gone about this?
Yeah. Yes. The word can resonate with just about anybody, Christian or not. And clearly that was an element of the popularity of the word that... As Elizabeth said, newspapers started writing articles about it. It was the word itself that appealed. And although some interpreted as a clearly a Christian message, especially in later decades, it was interpreted in a broader secular way. It also became associated with Arthur after he was unmasked in 56. So you had this personal element of his backstory weaved into it as well. So notions of hope and redemption and the possibility of change.
What do you think Arthur Stace would say today, knowing that we're here talking about his life and his work and this word 50 years on?
I think Arthur would just shake his head and say, all this fuss about me? He was so humble. He didn't really want any notoriety and publicity. He tried to stop my father from getting him to go public for 5 years, you know. And in the end, Dad just said to him, well, look, Arthur, you know, you're writing eternity because you're preaching the gospel. You want to tell people and warn them about eternity. But look at the life that you've come from. You know, how many people will relate to that story about your poverty and your poor upbringing, your alcoholism? You know, I think people should know your story. And so it was, you know, being able to come out and share it, I think, that people really relate to.
There's a cafe in Moldova, of all places, the old part of the old Soviet bloc before the Iron Curtain came down, called the Eternity Cafe, named after Arthur. And I love the story of one of the missionaries there. They started using Arthur's story to the locals. And he said, the story took fire because if there are two things that the Eastern Europeans understand, it's poverty and alcoholism. And Arthur's story, as Elizabeth was saying, resonated far more strongly than even the most erudite theologian could tell it.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore.
If you want to know more about Arthur Stace or buy the book, Mr. Eternity, written by Roy Williams and Elizabeth Myers, head to mreternity.com.au. There you'll also find a recording of the one and only radio interview Arthur Stace ever gave, back in 1964.
When do you do it? When do you find time to write this?
I get up early in the morning. I have 1 hour with the Lord between 4 and 5, and I have a cup of tea, and off I go on this particular work, writing eternity, wherever the Lord sends me.
What do you think of people who come up to you and see you writing it? Are you very often caught in the act?
Oh, yes, very often caught in the act, and they said, what's this goat doing now?
They think
they're
a fanatic, do you?
Yes. They say, oh, crazy, this man's a wreck. He's writing eternity. Look. And then they ask me the question about eternity, and I tell them, and they say, my word, you're pretty right. We've got to face it.
Next week, we celebrate Christmas with some drama and some beatboxing.
You should, like, totally break it down and some fucking... That was unexpected.